Forward Guidance is brought to you by VanEck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about VanEck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. I am joined by Dr. Luigi Zingales, professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Professor, very glad to welcome you to Forward Guidance. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that, Professor. A little under a year ago, you called for a commission to investigate the Federal Reserve and make sure everything was going on, given you said that the Fed had failed twice, one being too late with inflation, the other in raising rates too fast and causing the banking tremor of last spring. Tell us what motivated you to call for that commission.
Actually, the second time was not to raise it too fast, is not to pay attention to the collateral damage of what it was doing, because the Fed is not only responsible to peak interest rates, it's also responsible for the soundness of the banking sector. SVB and the other banks that went after it failed in the most traditional form, in the sense they basically were too invested long when interest rate went up and lost enough money. This is interest rate risk is the most benign form of risk that banks are exposed to. From the first thing that you learn in any banking class is beware of interest rate risk. So it's not like some complicated derivative that was just being invented and nobody knew what it was in plain sight. Actually, the banks were reporting in footnotes how much money they were losing. So you didn't even need to make complicated calculation. You needed to read the footnotes. And the complete inability or unwillingness to intervene, I think, is problematic, especially after we had a major financial reform in 2010, precisely to avoid the problems that we encountered in 2008. So in 2008, we had a major financial crisis. The Fed said, oh, the reason why we had the crisis is because we did not have enough power. So give us all the power. And the Dodd-Frank gave all the power, and they failed.
I think a lot of people focus on two powers of the Federal Reserve, interest rates and then the balance sheet. I guess there's also its role in bank regulation. So that would be your critique of the Fed in this second instance.
Absolutely. And this is, I think that now is becoming historical at this point, but the Fed was late to the game with the interest rates. And, you know, I'm Italian and Italians tend to be cynical. There was a former Italian prime minister saying, when you think the worst about a person, you commit a sin, but you're right. And so we tend to always think the worst. And my observation is that Powell started to talk about raising interest rates only after he was renominated by President Biden, and especially after was reappointed by the Senate. So he first wanted to get the job renewed, and then he decided. So that was a 6 or 7 month of delay that was pretty costly for the system. So that's error number one. But I think that the error number two, which to some extent is more problematic, because I don't think it's just a power problem, is an internal problem in the Fed, is that nobody is responsible for what went wrong. In a sense, in normal situation, when there is a major screw-up, you would like to have somebody that takes responsibility. In fact, I was at a conference the other day and came to my mind a brilliant idea, which is, if I may say so, is that in order to invoke the systemic exception, because, you know, Secretary Yellen, after the failure of SVB, decided to invoke a systemic exception and basically protect all the deposits. And I would like to introduce a norm that says that in order to invoke the systemic exception, somebody needs to lose his job. Like maybe the head of the Fed, because after all, the systemic exception means you screw up, right? It's so big, and it's not a small mistake. We all make small mistakes. But if you invoke the systemic exception, means that the entire system is at risk. And you are in charge of the entire system. How could you possibly invoke a systemic exception without resigning? in a sense, in the old days, they were committing karakiri, but I don't want to go that far.
In the old days, they were committing what?
In the old days, they used to do karakiri to kill themselves. But I don't want to be so brutal. I just think that they should simply resign in order to invoke the systemic exception. There must be a sacrificial lamb that say, I screwed up, we need to get the systemic exception. And I guarantee you that regulators will be more attentive after that.
That's so interesting and very amusing about the seppuku. So how do you think about organizations, whether Federal Reserve government organizations or in the private sector, when something bad happens and maybe someone needs to be punished? Let's say it really is the CEO who screwed up, but instead it's going to be someone who's reports to someone who reports to someone who reports to him, and that is the sacrificial lamb. And how do you sort of think about accountability? Like, and I mean, do you think someone from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors or someone who is chair or CEO of a member bank should have gone?
My inclination at the end of the day should be the top, so the chairman of the Fed, because the buck stops there, right? In a sense, you can always delegate responsibility and claim, etc. But I think it's cheap to say, for somebody below, you are paid to actually oversee what's done. Maybe somebody else should resign as well. But I think that if you were to legislate this, and just if this is a decision exposed, I think that what I would try to have is exactly an independent commission to determine who was responsible. A bit like the commission after the Challenger, where they tried to figure out what was wrong. And I think that commission was very useful to figure out the problems even inside NASA. So that's the reason why I think we should have had an external commission at the point, because Powell appointed an internal commission, but surprise, surprise, the internal commission blamed the only person who had left the Fed, which is sort of just a coincidence that the only person to be blamed is the one who just left the Fed.
How does accountability at the Federal Reserve compare to accountability to the private sector, whether it's private sector banks and bank boards or other companies that that are publicly traded in the private sector?
I think the accountability is limited even in the private sector, because CEOs tend to protect themselves, blame other people, most of the time settle paying with our money. And it's just all the big settlement that banks pay, they pay with shareholders' money, which is our 401k money. I'm very grandiose at paying with your money in order to save my behind. So I think that that's a bit the line. I have to say that I really admire, for example, Senator Warren, when she took to task the CEO of Wells Fargo, and rightly so. And he was gone the next week. It didn't last a day long. So I think that there is a need of public accountability, especially for people that manage so much money and have so much impact in millions of people. And I think that board of directors tend to be a bit slow to the game. They tend to be very co-opted. I think that I'm actually working with a colleague trying to figure out what can we do to make boards more accountable, because they're not accountable. But it seems that the Fed has done worse, because at least what happens in a company is when you do something really bad, the stock price drop. Mm-hmm. And when the stock price drops, then people get upset, and there is a dynamic that is interesting. But in the Fed, you don't see the stock price dropping. And so you need like an external trigger. That's the reason why I think that the systemic exception trigger, that when you invoke it, the head of the Fed should go, I think is a very good idea.
And so how do you think about making boards more accountable? What are the various solutions?
There is a tension, because boards have two functions. One function is to advise the CEO in his or her strategy. And the other is to monitor the CEO in his or her strategy and decide when the CEO has to go. It's a bit like the same situation that when you have a PhD student that is your advisee in the dissertation on the one hand, you need to encourage him or her and help him. But at the end, you also have to judge him or her as a final result. So that's a complicated process. However, I think at the moment, U.S. corporate boards, the closest thing to Soviet elections, because you have the number of seats equal to the number of people. You have the incumbents reappointed themselves. Votes are public, so it's even worse than the Soviet Union. Soviet Union, at least the vote was nominally secret, but public. And even if you don't get a majority of the votes, you still stay there. Okay, so if a majority of people withhold the vote, then most of the time you're caught and you stay there anyway. So it's very, very, unless you sort of really did not show up a number of times. So there are very formal things that if you don't show up 9 out of 10 meetings, maybe you're going to lose your job. But this is really kind of very mechanical and very low end. And most boards tend to be dominated by yes men, or because now we are more diverse and yes people, but has changed the gender, but not necessarily the behavior. And I think that that's problematic.
One potential solution posed by so-called activist investors is you get a large hedge fund. They buy maybe 1-2% of the shares. They convince a lot of people to sign away their rights, and then they become activists and say, oh, you know, stop the private planes, stop the vacations for all the corporate boards, the C-suites. You know, I think that became famous with Carl Icahn. That is one solution. What is your view of that solution? Is that solution of activist investors much more difficult now that so many shares of the public are owned by large passive funds, which are not really in the game of telling companies what to do? Or are there other solutions to fix corporate actions that you think might be better?
The activist solution works very well if the problem is that the firm is losing money, okay? Because activists are very focused. They come in, they replace who is losing money, and hopefully things get better. And because they have high power incentives, they do they act very promptly and they spend resources to fix it. And most of the time, Vanguard and BlackRock go along, especially if the company is misperforming. What is more problematic is when a company is doing something like Boeing that is under investing in safety and taking a wild gamble, and at the end of the day, not paying for it because you get the bailout because of COVID, you get this, you get that, you basically are the only producer of aircraft in America. So at this point, how can you possibly sort of do anything to Boeing? I think there is really, really problematic. And not only the CEOs don't pay any cost financially or even reputationally, even the board members don't pay any cost financially, reputationally. And then, you know, Carolyn Kennedy, the only living kid of President Kennedy, was on the board of Boeing when many of the terrible decisions were made. As a reward, she was appointed by Biden ambassador to Australia. Now, in the old days, that was a penal colony, and you were sent there when you were doing that. But these days, Australia is not a penal colony. It's a reward, okay? So I think that there is no accountability. In my own country, in Italy, there was a tragedy of a bridge that collapsed and killed 43 people. And this was a bridge of a motorway that was clearly under maintained for years. And it's just it's funny because this bridge had an expected life of 50 years and collapsed 51 years after inauguration. So the engineer were perfect in predicting the situation. It's just that the motorway company did not do enough maintenance to keep it up. At the end of the day, the Italian press never mentioned any of the board members as responsible for this. At the very minimum, there is a moral responsibility of what you're doing. I'm not a lawyer and depend on the legal system, so I'm not going to venture into the legal responsibilities. But at the very minimum, it should be a stain in your reputation that you were there, you were supposed to monitor, and you did it. And I think against these problems, activist investors are not particularly very helpful in this dimension.
So what might be some solutions if it's not activist investors for problems that are not problems of companies losing money?
This is the delicate issue. I think that there should be more transparency in some dimension. But the question is, you know, at the board level, you want to maintain confidentiality because on the business strategy side, you want to maintain confidentiality. However, when it comes to things that can jeopardize the life and the safety of citizens, I think that their privacy and confidentiality should be removed. For example, I learned, and it's something that I'm studying, so I learned that in the United States, if you are a bridge engineer, and you see a bridge that is at risk, you have a duty to report, even if you have nothing to do with that bridge. It's a bit like if you are a policeman and you are on vacation, you have a duty to intervene when you see a robbery. I think that if you are a civil engineer and expert in bridges, you need to intervene. My understanding is this is not the case in Italy. And what this company did is they hire multiple consultants and until they got the right answer, right? So they go to the first consultant, the first consultant say, oh, this is problematic. Oh, we don't like you. Next one. And then finally, you find somebody that say everything is fine. But all these consultants were bound by the confidentiality agreements. So they did some tests. They knew that the bridge was at risk, but they had no ability to go and expose this publicly, which is terrible.
You think there should be a reward for calling out bad actions?
I am a big fan of the whistleblower statute. I think that it's been very, very useful in fraud against the government and also in IRS fraud. And since it has been introduced in an edulcorated form in corporate fraud, has also improved. So I think that we should do some of that. But I think that, you know, it's a question of carrot and stick. You should have the carrot, but you should also have the stick, and you should have a responsibility. And certainly, we want to avoid any confidentiality agreement when the life of people is at risk. So the fact that I inspect a bridge, I find the bridge to be dangerous, but I cannot say that because I have a contract with a company, seems to be against the public interest.
Yeah, so in general, NDAs often can be against the public interest.
Yeah.
Like gold did, Bitcoin is establishing itself as a macro asset that potentially helps hedge against the government devaluation of your money. Finally, you can easily access Bitcoin in a low-cost ETF with the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today. Visit VanEck.com/HODLFG to learn more. That's VanEck.com/HODLFG. Now the disclosures. Investing involves risk and you could lose money on an investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL. The value of Bitcoin and therefore the value of the Trust shares could decline rapidly, including to zero. You could lose your entire principal investment. For a more complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. Thanks, let's get back to the interview.
How would you assess the current state of corporate governance? You know, if let's say in the late 1990s and early 2000s, you know, it's, with the benefit of hindsight, we could say corporate governance in the U.S. was very weak with the Enron scandal, which your podcast host Bethany McLean wrote about in her legendary book, your podcast Capital Isn't. You know, and that led to the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley. How successful was Sarbanes-Oxley in curbing the excesses of corporate malfeasance, and what problems remain? What still needs to be done?
One of the important points of Sarbanes-Oxley that was very contentious at the time was Section 404 that requires companies to have internal controls to make sure that cash doesn't disappear from the face of Earth. And I think that in that respect has been fairly good as a result of that. Not perfect, but fairly good. The companies fought very, very aggressively against Section 404. But I think the result has been overall positive. One of my suggestions would be to extend this internal control system, integrity of the internal control system, also for other dimensions, like, for example, safety or pollution, so stuff that otherwise is not reported, so that there is a clear channel of responsibility. Because in Boeing, you fracture the responsibility of the choices so many times that at the end, nobody's responsible, right? And I think that that's problematic because you want people to feel a responsibility because they are going to act against. And says, I would think that 99% of the people, if they say, look, you make a little bit of money, but you really put at risk thousands of people falling down from the sky, they're not going to do it. Okay. And it's just people are motivated by money, but not only by money. The problem is that nobody feels that responsibility. And everybody said, oh, I do my job, but I let somebody else do it. And that is passing the hot potato to somebody else. At the end, nobody's responsible. And that's a cause of a lot of problems. So I think that in that dimension, this is important. The other thing, which is actually an interesting topic for today, is that there is a big fight between the PCAOB, which is a creation of Sarbanes Oxley. The PCAOB, for the listener, is the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. It's probably the most important agency you never heard of. Their job is to audit the auditors. And the PCAOB has issued a rule that say that auditors are responsible also to report non-compliance by the companies. So that if I am the auditor and I notice something that is problematic, I have an active duty to report to the board of directors, to the head of the risk committee, and so on and so forth. And I think that auditors don't want to take that responsibility. They are fighting back. But I think that that's a very important issue because I think that with good auditing and good inspections, you can monitor a lot of things. And I have been on boards of companies in Italy for several years, and I've seen sort of how things get hidden when they want to hide them and how it can be revealed by good inspection and good auditing. And so I think especially these days with statistical method and data analysis, I think that is very, very possible to have a good monitoring system. In fact, I would claim that somebody should write a program or do a course of data analysis for board members. But, you know, again, there's no demand for this because if I am the CEO, I don't want board members who are too educated in data analysis. And so if I want to become a board member, I don't want to take the course because the course will disqualify me rather than qualify me.
Boeing comes to mind as a public example of corporate malfeasance. What else comes to mind in terms of something which in a company which in recent memory has really crossed the line, that to use a very salient example?
Oh, I think Wells Fargo is another one. We mentioned it before. I think is think about Merck. I don't know if you remember the Vioxx scandal. The Vioxx was an anti-inflammatory that was working in a different way than the traditional anti-inflammatory like aspirin or Aleve. You know, it was tested, and in a clinical trial, they showed that Vioxx was a little bit better on your stomach. However, there were five times as many heart-related accidents than if you took Aleve. In spite of that, it was approved, and for 3 years was in commerce. The estimate is, I don't know how many thousands of people that die prematurely as a result of that. It's pretty stunning because the board member was composed of very smart people. But if you read the study, you don't need to be a scientist to understand there is something deeply wrong. But they were able to explain themselves out. And it's just when there's a lot of money on the table, you'll be surprised of how people can be convinced. In fact, there is a very famous sentence by Afton Sinclair. It's impossible to convince people of something their salary depend on.
Do you think that public markets, I'm not just talking about markets, but the bond market, the stock market, help with corporate governance? In other words, they incentivize good behavior, or do they do more harm than good in terms of corporate governance?
I think that they do incentivize behavior, especially the equity market. I think that when it comes to trying to maximize profits, I think we've done remarkable progress since the 70s to today. My concern is that we have not made equal progress on other margins. In particular, when you have a very steep incentive scheme, when a lot of money rides on you succeeding, I think that the incentives to cheat and hide, etc., become very big. I always tell people, imagine that they put me in a basketball court and they tell me that if I win a game, I gain $100 million. Not only I'm short, so I'm already handicapped for basketball, but I don't know how to play basketball. So there is no way in which I can even remotely think that if the game is fair, I can win. But, you know, for $100 million, the temptation to play on other margins, like, for example, trying to corrupt the referee or to change the rules of the game or to play a bit of a strong sort of a elbowing game or whatever, are pretty strong. And so one of the lessons that you learn in economics is that when you increase incentive schemes in one dimension, you need to increase the incentives in the other dimension as well. Otherwise, this will lead to a strong asymmetry. And so if we want to keep people motivated, high paper performance is good. But on the other hand, there should be a very strong sort of punishment if you deviate. Also strong monitoring to avoid them to deviate to begin with, because very often it's convenient to make a lot of money, be punished, and then ask for forgiveness or go to the Cayman Island and live happily ever after without facing any responsibility.
Well, how do you think the ESG movement, environmental society and governance, which aims to apply, you know, somewhat quantitative metrics to how companies are run for ESG reasons, how successful has that been? It's become increasingly large in the US and very large in Europe. So what have the successes of that been in your view, as well as the shortcomings?
I learned that the reason why there are so many charlatans in the spiritual dimension is because the spiritual dimension is so important. Okay, we are trying to find a higher purpose, and you know, we have a lot of organized religion, but you have a lot of also charlatans around. But the space for charlatans is proportional to how important the topic is. So I think that the issue of environmental social responsibility governance is a little bit on the side, because I think we have made a lot of progress on that dimension. But the issue of the environment, the social, are very, very big. As a result, the world is populated by a lot of charlatans and a lot of people who pretend. And I'm not saying that all of it is like this, but I think that we need to do some serious work to separate the chaff from the wheat, because there's a lot of talk and relatively little walk.
How could that be improved? If tomorrow you became, you know, running the ESG movement, what would you change?
I'm a big supporter of what is called corporate democracy. The fact that we should give shareholders more power to actually determine how decision about values are made in corporations. So there are trade-offs. If we tell people that is a win-win situation, I think is easy, but I don't think everything is win-win. I think that in many situations, there is a cost. As I said earlier, you need to pay some cost to make borrowing more secure. Are you willing to pay or not? I think that most people individually would like to do that, but then as a company, then end up not doing that. I think that to me is the major failure. And I think what we need to have is some involvement and some honesty. First of all, I don't think that most companies will have the courage to go in front of the shareholder and say, oh, we are going to save some money at the expense of making our plane a little bit less safe. I think that that would not be a non-starter. So I think that confronted with that possibility, they will make plane more safe, period. But second, on issue, for example, of emissions, I think that, the optimal amount of CO2 emission is not zero. Otherwise, we should kill ourselves because we produce CO2 by breathing, right? So there is a trade-off. And the question is, how much are you willing to sacrifice for that trade-off? So let's have a vote. Are you willing to pay $100 a barrel, $100 to reduce 1 ton of CO2, or are you willing to pay $50? Are we willing to pay nothing? But at the end of the day, the shareholders are the one paying, and they're the ones suffering the consequences. So it would be nice to have them making this decision rather than having these charismatic CEOs that make big statements, but then it's not obvious what the statement means in practice.
And how do you think about participation in those shareholder actions? In other words, if you all shareholders, including people who own from 1 million shares to just 1 share, receive, you know, in the mail or in their email, vote on this, vote on that. I imagine a lot of people, they're at work, they're doing stuff with their family, they're not going to vote, especially when it's, you know, they just own the S&P 500 and Boeing is just but one company in that. Is it kind of maybe a challenge similar to direct democracy where, you know, I want the mayor of New York where I live to deputize people to build roads and bridges. Like I don't need necessarily to vote on every road and bridge.
You're absolutely right. Almost half Americans don't even vote for the presidential election, and they take only once every 4 years. Imagine for 500 elections every year. That is unthinkable. However, I think you use the right analogy, direct democracy. We don't necessarily need to have direct democracy. We can have, one situation, we could have indirect democracy, i.e., you can have some guidelines you give to your mutual funds. Most people these days own stocks through mutual funds. And so you say, I pick this particular guideline, and then the fund will make sure that your shares are both based on that guideline. And some of these guidelines already exist, some might be created in the future, but it's a very cheap thing to do to implement that. A second, this is actually an idea that I'm developing with Ellen Landemore, who was a guest in my podcast, and Oliver Hart, is the idea of maybe using alternative forms of democracy to solve this problem. So Ellen Landemore is famous because she promotes what are called citizen assemblies, which are randomly selected group of people trying to decide on a topic. Okay, and at the beginning it seems crazy, but if you think of it, the birth of democracy in Athens was based on lotocracy. You randomly select people to represent the population. And so imagine that you randomly select 100 investors in Vanguard, and you put them in a room, you supply them with information, and you ask them to decide how they're going to vote on various issues of values. And most people, especially if they are pay a minimum amount, will do that because you know that you're one of 100, you'll make a big difference. If you are one of a million, you know that your contribution is irrelevant. But out of 100, I think you're more likely to participate, and you're representative. And so I think that that's an alternative. So this is to say, I think that the problem you raise does exist, but there are potential avenues to solve it, and we should explore them rather than say it's impossible. So let's keep the status quo.
Now moving on to financial technology, fintech. You're teaching a course right now about the fintech revolution. And I gather just from reading that the two most salient technologies are one, blockchain, and two, peer-to-peer lending. How would you describe the current state of financial technology, and how would you place it in the context of starting with the 14th century with the Italians inventing double entry accounting, and then, you know, you have people inventing the credit default swap in the late 1900s. How would you assess the current state of finance, and where do you think it's going?
I would put the goal of the class slightly differently. So I tell my students, at the essence, finance is nothing but transfer of values across space, across time, and across contingencies. And this transfer of value is mostly impeded by two things. Number one, the transaction cost of organizing this. And number two is the asymmetry of information that might make me not trust you that you return your money later on, or might induce you to run away with the money after I trust you. With the invention of the little device called smartphone, we have changed dramatically these frictions. So transaction costs have dropped enormously, and even informational asymmetry has been reduced dramatically. And it's just, I told you I was on a board of a telecom company, and at the time, before the introduction of the smartphone, there was a discussion of whether we had a product that was an ankle bracelet for convicted felons. That when they were going on parole, they would have to wear this so they could be located at every time. And there was a discussion whether this was inhumane or not. Today, everybody voluntarily carries an electronic ankle that is called smartphone. That allows us to monitor everything you're doing. And so that is really changing at the core all the financial functions. So the smartphone has changed the way we shop, the way we read the newspaper, the way we even date, change everything. And so it is changing also the way we do finance. And I think that blockchain is just one of the potential applications, but I think that the picture is much, much bigger. I think that we are undergoing a dramatic change in the business model of banking, for example, at a level that we've not seen since the invention of banking.
And what is that change in banking?
Today is much, in my view, much more efficient to have a central bank deal with our payment system, either directly or indirectly, because the technology is there, and the centralization of the payment allows also the distribution of information. So we know from the beginning of banking that handling your payment also provide the bank with a lot of information about you, and so favors lending. However, the flip side of that is that information is only available to the bank, and so it's a monopoly vis-a-vis that information, and so they can exploit a monopoly against you. And in Europe, the regulators are trying to undermine this by mandating open banking, which means that if you shop or pay with Citibank, but then you want to provide that information to Bank of America, you simply authorize Bank of America to list your information on Citibank, and you're in a competitive scenario. However, banks, not surprisingly, hate this, and they're trying to do everything in their power to make this process as difficult as possible. Okay? If you have this information centralized at the Fed, then the Fed, by mandate, cannot lend to people. And so if not a competitor, we'd be happy to share the information with whoever you want. And so I think for the first time, we can separate the business of payment from the business of lending in a major way. Okay? And the big advantage of this is then we can have a business of lending completely in private hands, where people can fail, and we don't care if they fail because they cannot disrupt the payment system. And then the payment system completely in public hands, and nobody can threaten that they are too big to fail because nobody is too big to fail.
So first, my first question is, would this system of the Federal Reserve keeping information on everyone in the payment system, would that require an operational know-how? Because it sounds like you don't have a lot of confidence in the Federal Reserve to manage the individual's banks managing their most basic risk, which is interest rate risk. So it sounds like maybe this is a lot more complicated, keeping data on every single person with a bank account.
I think that you are right, but there are ways to do it or to delegate an extra layer to do it. What is important to me is the risk, the balance sheet risk associated with payments is firstly insured by the Fed and controlled by the Fed. And I think that is the key element. And second, I know that a lot of people are reluctant to go in that direction because they say, oh, the moment that the Fed knows all this data, then they can use it against you and the government is evil, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sympathetic to this view. However, let's remember that after January 6th, Bank of America volunteered the information of who withdraw the money around Capitol Hill to the Fed. They volunteer that information. Okay?
I did not know that.
So what I'm saying is, once that information is there, if the government wants it, they're going to get it. So I actually prefer a system in which the information is in the hands of the government. And as a result, we put some infrastructure to protect and to mandate how this can be done, rather than put it in private hands and you don't know how they're going to use it or trade that information.
Can you share more light on the difference between the credit risk and the payments risk? Because when I think of Bank A goes down, the systemic risk is that the losses exceed the equity. And therefore, if Bank B has deposits or a loan to Bank A, then Bank B goes down and then, you know, the dominoes fall. How would the Federal Reserve operating the payment system improve that situation in a, so that Bank A could take as much credit risk as it wants?
It's huge because currently, if I have to pay you for the meal you pay for me, I can either, if I'm old fashioned, give you a check, or I can transfer some money in with PayPal, etc. Let's take the old-fashioned way of a check. My check can have no funds in the bank, and you are left without ability to get the money from me. Okay. The difference is that if you pay through the Fed, you're simply transferring money that is at the Fed from your name to my name. And so the Fed knows exactly whether the money is there and they authorize it to transfer. And so there is no risk of payment because we transfer some stuff that is in centralized hands in the Fed. So we eliminate the role of banks as creator of a form of money, taking deposits or taking line of credit, but it's a form of money. How does lending will take place? Lending will take place is taking place today in peer-to-peer lending or now I call marketplace lending, in which you deposit for money for at least a month, but they say 2 years or whatever, and that money goes to pay for a loan on the other side of the balance sheet. But you tend to have a match asset and liability. So number one, there's not a lot of risk involved, but even if there is risk and the banks were to fail, will not be in doubt who gets paid, who doesn't get paid, okay? So there will be some loans that are not renewed or some investors that lose their money, but they know they're taking a risk. So if I want to have my safe payment system, I go and I deposit everything at the Fed and I take no risk.
So all deposits are with the Federal Reserve?
All short-term deposits. Now, I will only allow banks to take term deposits, like a month or 3 months, and those will not be a substitute to money because they are term deposits.
That makes sense. I mean, that would be a very radical change to the financial system. So, I mean, I imagine so much would be different in that financial system than the one we currently have today. What else are the factors that how else would it be different?
So the biggest factor is, you know, we always talk about senior age as the money, the interest that the Fed earns on its cash and its deposits, and that's a pretty substantial amount of money. We're talking about 30 or 40 billion a year in a normal year, in especially years even much more. But that's only the current level of seniority. There is a level of seniority associated with the deposit, the fact that why do you keep your deposits at Citibank at 5 basis points when the Fed fund rate is at 5.5 or whatever it is because of convenience. So that is also seniority. And that's in the order of $200 billion. Okay, so we're talking about real money. And I think that that amount is, in principle, should be rebated to customers through competition. But we know that the banking sector is not very competitive. So that is basically rent that is accumulated by banks in the process. So this would be rebated straight to the Treasury. So that would be less taxes for both of us and the less profits of banks. So if you are Jamie Dimon, you don't like this idea.
Yes, not at all.
Sorry to interrupt. Just want to tell you about Blockworks' upcoming crypto symposium in London, the Digital Asset Summit, which is running from March 18th to March 20th. Everyone in crypto is going to be there, not just the experts and policymakers, but the real industry leaders writing the checks. Over $800 billion in assets is going to be represented. Anyone who's anyone in crypto is going to be there. So if you're into crypto and you haven't bought your ticket yet, the time is now to get your ticket. I would not wait any longer. We've got some exciting guests on the macro side too. Julian Brigden, Michael Howell. And yes, I can confirm at last the rumors are true. Joseph Wang, the Fed guy himself, is going to be there too. I'll be hosting a panel with these macro heavyweights that you don't want to miss. So be there or be square. Click the link in the description and use code FG10 to get 10% off. Thanks. Let's get back to the interview.
What is it like being an economist where, you know, unlike physics or chemistry, you're studying something that, you know, impacts people that they experience every day, and one where the assumptions are constantly changing, the correlations between different variables are always changing, whereas photon is always going to act in a certain way, whereas a bank deposit or a stock does not follow a rule of nature?
I think I find it is an extremely exciting field, precisely because it's so complex and not so easy to reduce to a mathematical formula. So I think that you need to know math well, but you need to know psychology and you need to know sociology. So I think that what makes economics a wonderful topic to study is that it's very complex, and so requires you to not only know math, but also know sociology and psychology and trying to put them all together. And it can be frustrating precisely because it's so difficult, but it's also very exciting. And I think impacts people in a dramatic way. And as I said, I don't want to reduce the contribution of other fields, which are extremely important. But if you think about how devastating the financial crisis was and how to these days the GDP per capita, the income per capita of Americans is lower than what it would have been if the financial crisis had not occurred, is really, really important to make a difference in that dimension. So I think that it's a very challenging area, but with enormous rewards if you improve even by an epsilon our understanding in that area.
It makes me think of an interesting question, which is, I know many different measures of economic strength, whether it's GDP or spending or investment, declined drastically during the Great Financial Crisis. And although they increased from 2009 to 2019, they were very much below trend. So people call that decade of lost growth. But I think for some measures, such as like U.S. spending, that it's actually not just above the trend of 2019, but it's above the 2007 trend. So do you think that, asking questions about economic forecasting is very difficult, but do you think that the American economy is out of the post-Great Financial Crisis slump?
I think that part of it is, yes, it is away from the slump, but it's a bit like if you don't go to school for 2 years during COVID, you are maybe catching up to the level of knowledge, but you're always a bit behind in your development as a result of 2 years where you didn't go to school. And I think that the American economy is a little bit like that.
From the great financial crisis or from COVID?
Mostly because of the great financial crisis, yeah.
Professor, as we reach a close, let's end where we started, talking about the Federal Reserve. The federal funds rate now is at 5.375%. Do you think that the Federal Reserve, that interest rates are too restrictive, and that the Federal Reserve needs to cut interest rates in order to prevent a recession or improve the banking system?
I think that the outlook has been much better than I expected, to be honest. And part of it has been that the inflation has fallen without seeing a major impact on the economic activity. My suspicion, I don't have the data to prove it, my suspicion is that it's all a consequence of a massive amount of immigration, most of it illegal. So if you have a lot of immigration, you have a downward pressure on wages, and you have high demand, and you also have a fake higher productivity because you don't report the people who work. And so as a result, GDP goes up, you don't see more employed, and so, productivity goes up. But it's all the influx of illegal immigration. So in that sense, the Fed was lucky because it could rely on this pressure to keep inflation under control. I am concerned about the effect in the commercial real estate that start to be pretty severe. And I suspect that we're going to see other problems in regional banks that are particularly exposed to commercial real estate. So I don't think we're out of the woods yet. Certainly, the outcome so far has been better than what I expected. But that is no guarantee that it will continue this way.
And tell us about your view on commercial real estate. Where are the weaknesses of the financial system, and how does it compare to prior weaknesses in commercial real estate, 2008, I think early 1990s, stuff like that?
There are two major differences. The first one is that we might be around a structural crisis, not just a cyclical one. The problem is that structural crises manifest themselves first as a cyclical one, and then you realize you don't bounce back, and so it's structural. I think with the enormous development of online commerce, et cetera, I think that we are more in a structural crisis. And so in that sense, it's a different crisis, because in the other crisis, if you extend and pretend it, you will sort of come up ahead. I'm not so sure that is going to be the case. And second, that as a result, in part of regulation, the financial markets sort of concentrated a lot of the risk on regional banks that are less monitored than large banks. And those banks tend to be less resilient than than large banks. And so the risk of seeing problems, again, like we see in SVB, are real.
And you said extend and pretend might not work like it did in the past for banks. What is the reason for that?
Oh, because it's a structural crisis. If it's a cyclical crisis, you know that if you just hold on, eventually the prices will come back up. In New York, prices, the trend has always been up, and there have been downturns, but if you hold on enough, eventually this will pay off. But if you are in the business of buggy whip, and then all of a sudden cars started to come, holding on to buggy whips will not make them valuable. So I think that that's part of the problem.
So the buggy whip is offices, and the car automobile is working from home.
Offices and also retail spaces.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your insights. People can find you on Twitter at Zingales, and they should check out your podcast, Capital Isn't. Thank you again, and thank you everyone for watching.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/hodlfg to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. A reminder that forward guidance episodes are available on all podcast apps and on Twitter, where I post them regularly at JackFarley96. Thanks again. Until next time.